Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wiss. Let's take a ride.
Hey, everybody. This is the Brothers Wiss number 98. I am Greg Sewell from Texas. Today we have two of the regs. We've got Mikey from Chicagoland.
Hey, how's it going?
And we've got Thomas Kiernak from Slovakia.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. You know, Thomas, how is it that you still haven't gotten a camera going, yet you run a technology company?
I have it at the office, and since we do the podcast, at times which I am not in the office.
Got you.
For example, right now it's 1:15 a.m. Well, there's no camera at home, so you get no video.
Gotcha. So you're completely naked, is what you're telling me.
No comment. I won't confirm nor deny.
Good times. Well, I'm just trying to, I'm just trying to attract more viewers to the YouTube. Obviously, it's not working yet. We'll see. All right, you guys ready? You feeling pumped?
Yeah, I suppose.
As you can hear from all the cheers and everything.
Yeah, the lackluster screaming. All right, good deal. So, Thomas, you actually posted something a little while back, within the last 2 weeks, I guess, about worshipping. Not like worshipping, like you go to church thing, but war and then the word shipping, which I thought was really interesting article. Would you like to elaborate?
Yeah, I completely loved it. It's extremely creative and extremely dangerous. So the concept is that with the proliferation of super cheap microcomputers, SBCs, single board computers, like the Raspberry Pi Zero, penetration testers and therefore also hackers and attackers are actually now shipping physical boxes which include a Raspberry Pi Zero, a 3G or 4G connection, and a battery. And you basically hide that inside of the wall of the board, inside of the box, inside of the cardboard. And it's an amazing attack vector. And I'm sure we will link the article. It's a very fascinating read that actually... and you can hide all kinds of stuff in there, right? Microphones, obviously your Wi-Fi will be in promiscuous mode and listening to all the Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. Also, what's even more funny, what do you do when you have a bigger box? Well, you carry it, right? So if you have some proximity sensors in there or card readers, by cards, I mean, of course, RFID, there is a very good chance you will pick up somebody's access cards or other RFID cards that are in proximity of that box for the people that are carrying it. And it's a really clever attack method, physical attack method. And you can take this much further, and the article goes into details. For example, this was a security company, obviously, so they were hired to do penetration testing, to do a vulnerability assessment. And they actually shipped like a plaque, a trophy, you could say, or some kind of achievement plaque to the company. And they actually put it up on the wall without checking what was inside of the case. And inside of the case of this plaque was a Raspberry Pi Zero recording and everything else. And they actually recorded conversation, picked up SSIDs, picked up network traffic, picked up RFID tags and many other things. And it's really amazing how much damage a unchecked box or an unchecked package can do these days.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of how I think it was like a U.S. diplomat at an embassy in maybe Russia. They gave him like a big carved eagle and, for his office or whatever. And he stuck it in there and inside they had hauled it out and put kind of a listening device and everything in there. So it feels very Cold War. I kind of like the ingenuity behind it, but also the idea that, less than $100 worth of kit, you could make... I mean, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a listening device or something like that, right? You could have it just listen for Wi-Fi or something like that, right? And so it senses that SSID. All right, it's available. That means I'm in the building. So now I wait 45 minutes and then I catch fire or something like that, you know, set off the smoke alarm and then you could come inside or whatever. I mean, there's just, and like the idea of you saying that you could record RFID tags and things like that, that's brilliant. And they were also saying that they got it to go inside of a facility where cell phones aren't even allowed, right?
Yeah, if you don't check, like if you hide it well enough, which, I mean, a Raspberry Pi Zero W, the one with Wi-Fi, it's a tiny little thing, like it's
absolutely small,
half of your credit card, and I mean thickness is also the same as a credit card, it's tiny, you know, and you can power it off of a battery for literally days, right? And also a 3G/4G modem for upload is also super tiny, and you know, you can schedule that to only activate at night so there's less suspicion, and there's like all kinds of funky stuff you can do with this, right? And yeah, it will run off of a battery for days. It's tiny, so you can easily hide it inside of a wall of a box. It's very hard to detect and hard to pick up, and it's just very ingenious and quite dangerous.
Well, I mean, I think too, in your average environment, you could just look for an open access point and connect to it, right? The guest Wi-Fi, and then...
Oh, yeah, and not just that, right? It's a full-featured Linux system, so just put in Airship, Aircrack, whatever you have, and go directly after the Wi-Fi clients, you know, do de-authentication attacks, spin up a rogue SSID, all of this is possible, you know, or if you connect somewhere, just do a layer 2 attack, you know, ARP attacks, overtake the gateway, route all the traffic to yourself, you know, there's a billion attacks you can do with the things like this for like under $100, and it will sneak up into your physical location, and we all know when you are inside of the management network or inside of the NOC or, you know, inside of secured networks or locations where, as you say, even smartphones are prohibited, you know, that physical restriction is a layer of security, right? And that layer of security can be super easily breached with something like this, and once you are past that layer of security, which is actually quite important, the physical location, you know, then yeah, you've bypassed a large chunk of, you know, what was supposed to protect the network or protect the users.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, another interesting thing too is you could you could address it to network operations and then have a little pinhole camera in this guy as well, right? They make fiber optic cameras and things like that, and so you could actually get a layout of how to navigate to various areas, and like you were saying, you might be able to get their RFID credentials. If not, you get a good lay of the land on pretty much the full path you would need to walk to navigate this facility. I think it sounds like fun. Like, this would be such a brilliant adventure. I've always said that I wanted to rob a bank. Like, if I could do anything for fun, I think I would love to rob a bank, which sounds bizarre, right? I mean, as well as not get shot or go to prison. Given the opportunity as a challenge, I think it probably wouldn't be that bad. I think it would be a lot of fun too. Have you ever done escape rooms? You guys have ever done those?
I have. I've been wanting to, but not one enough, I guess, bad enough to actually do it.
I think they're pretty brilliant. I really enjoy it. Just kind of the puzzle aspect of it, right? The escape, you're going against the clock, and it's just your ingenuity against somebody else's. You know, recently I played, for the second time now, I played D&D with some friends of mine, but it's really fast and loose, and it's my friend's wife who is the dungeon master, and she writes, like, young adult novels, so she can, like, ad-lib stuff just right off the bat. Like, we were doing something, and she was just writing, like, I was reading something in a random book, and so she just made some stuff up on the spot and, like, handed it to me. I liken that to an escape room, but for your mind, right? It's just your imagination against somebody else's. I like the idea of fast and loose as well with a lot of this stuff, right? So you don't have to necessarily color within the lines. You can kind of use whatever creativity you can come up with, which is why I just absolutely love the ingenuity of this, right? It's I love the thought experiment, the hypothetical. If you could do this thing, given the challenge, how would you approach this? You know, and I think this is such a brilliant real-world solution in today's day and age, especially here in the States, Thomas, where I think the average household probably gets one package from Amazon a week minimum, right? We're so accustomed to seeing cardboard boxes move in and out of facilities that, I mean, they are virtually invisible. I mean, wouldn't you agree, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I've got like, you know, I don't even realize when boxes come because there's just so much crap that my wife buys online.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even going to say it's like a millennial thing. I think it's an everybody thing now that just you order it and it comes. Is that true for Slovakians, Thomas? Or are you guys still kind of, you go to the shops and pick stuff up?
Yeah, it's been all moving to, yeah, online and shipping and packages here as well. It's just logical, right, from economics and logistics standpoint.
Gotcha. Well, I think we need to at some point do a hypothetical, an IT hypothetical podcast, how we're gonna do some crazy stuff and see what we can come up with, just a few IT guys. I think some well-intentioned IT guys could, or I guess maybe some poorly intentioned IT guys could take over the world if they wanted to, given the time and inclination and, you know, not the fear of prison. I think that's kind of holds a lot of people back from that stuff.
Oh, I mean, it just depends, right? For things like this, if you do it right, there is very little chance of getting caught, right? You can ship a package completely anonymously, right? There is no tracking if you do it right on a package. And of course, things have, you know, serial numbers and MAC addresses and etc. But if you know what you are doing, you can easily manipulate all that.
Yeah. Right?
It's just silicon, the hardware, right? The software, if you are smart enough, if you know what you are doing, you can make it impossible to track. Of course, the biggest question is always how to exfiltrate the data, right? How to get the data out of the device, which is a little bit more complicated, I suppose, but still, right? If you know what you are doing, if you use zombie machines, if you use normal nefarious ways the botnets and all the attackers and hackers hide themselves, you know, it's very easy to basically be for this to be untraceable.
Yeah, and even a facility that basically the outside's an RF cage and you can't get into Wi-Fi, you just wait for them to throw the box in the trash, right?
Yeah, exactly. You can easily like wake it up once, or you know, have some goal, some objective to capture some data. Once you get those data, just wake it up once every couple of hours, you know, check if you can connect to the cellular network. If not, go back to sleep, right? This can be alive of a battery for days without a problem.
Yeah. And I bet you could order most of this stuff off of AliExpress, which means it would, cheap Chinese electronics are probably a lot harder to track down to who actually purchased them versus anything else. So,
you can buy this at physical brick and mortar stores for cash, right? And how are you going to track that?
Yeah, for sure. All right. Anything else on that subject? Because that's a black hole I could fall down because I think it's so brilliant.
I just love it. It's super creative. It's super, you know, extremely dangerous. And it relates to our field. And just, it's amazing how, you know, technology, while of course it's amazing how it's evolving, you know, also the ways that people find to use it for nefarious reasons are evolving and are amazing as well.
Yeah. I think it's brilliant. It's brilliant. There's so many smart people out there. I love it. I love seeing, it's like, for me, it's like walking through IKEA and I just, you know, you go through the kitchen, you're like, that's so clever. That's so clever. Just constantly, just the ingenuity of humans. I love that stuff.
So yeah, we'll definitely leave a link to the article and I recommend reading it. It's a very interesting read.
For sure. All right, Mikey, Wispapalooza 2019 is coming up. What do you have? What do you have to tell us about it?
It's in just over 2 weeks, so we'll have one more podcast before the show. All the discounts expired yesterday, so if you're wanting to go now, you're gonna have to butter up to a vendor or just pay full price. Trying something a little bit different this year. You know, we tried it a couple of years ago of having somebody not me do the interviews, so that I can actually do something else during the show. And we have that again this year. We've got little brother Tommy will be manning the camera this year.
Decent. Yeah, it's I did it once, and it is so much work. I mean, it was quite literally going nonstop the whole time. So
and there you go, scaring everybody off that would potentially be interested for the next years.
Man, I will try and be as transparent as possible. Obviously, you're going to have a good time because you still get to do the after-hour stuff. You can still run around, but man, it is a ton of work. Dude, my feet were so tired. They were busted after the first day. So good luck to Tommy.
Yeah, and then I do this by myself every other show in addition to the show. So it'd be nice to kind of cut some of that out. But I just started reaching out to vendors to try to get them scheduled up. Wispo hasn't told us what they want us to do yet, so hopefully it's not ridiculous. Yeah, we'll see. I think it's be the first time. Well, so was it for one? Was it last Vegas show is when we started with the better microphone setup, I believe. So that's kind of the big thing for us is, you know, making that audio so that you guys actually want to listen to it.
Yeah. Onward and upward, and everything we can do to make it better. Might have to do some cleanup on those conference floor stuffs, but we're going to be doing lapel microphones this year, so everything should be a little bit better, right? A little better every year. That's what we always shoot for.
Yeah. And I don't have much more to say because I haven't actually been paying attention as to what's going on. I've been busy with other work.
Sure.
Just kind of wanted to get that out there.
All right. Excellent. Well, hopefully people will be on the lookout for Tommy, and maybe he can record some just people there, talking to them about why they come and all that good stuff as well. So if you're you're out there, be sure to look for Tommy with the camera.
Definitely, I'm going to try to get him to do some, you know, people interviews. If you have something that you want to hear from a particular vendor, tell them to reach out to us so that we can get them booked in a time slot. Because I know I'm not up to speed as to what's going on and who has stuff that's worth talking about. So, and I don't have time to beat on the vendors myself. That takes weeks. So you guys go to your vendors you want to hear from and tell them to reach out to us. We'll give them the link. They can sign up for a slot and we can get them on camera talking about it.
All right. Well, that actually reminds me, while we're talking about vendors and them reaching out to us, found out that last week we got trolled by MicroTik with the new hardware we found in the MPAK file. Apparently that's been there for over 2 years. It was part of an April Fool's joke, and they just, I guess, forgot about it. My understanding is we forgot about that and then had a good laugh when you brought it back up. So how fortunate for us to have all of those conversations about chipsets and types and things and blah, 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 when it turns out it was just a really old April Fool's joke.
Yeah,
you guys got trolled really well.
Surprise, surprise.
And I remember now watching that, you know, presentation, because I was wanting to see what was new, you know what the new products were, and I remember watching it one time and it was, oh damn it. Yeah. But yeah, that was been 2.5 years ago, and just forgot. And then like somebody brought that up on one of the mailing lists, I think it was AFMUG, about there being new CCRs, and then linked
the Meow routers.
And then, you know, linked to our video, and it's like, well, yeah, we did talk about that, but here's a link to a video showing that that's a bunch of crap. You know, sorry, we got trolled. And then it was still like 3 or 4 back and forth before I got people to realize that, no, like, we were trolled, this link that I'm sending you from 2.5 years ago is evidence that we were trolled. It's made up. Stop going on about this router. And yeah, it took a little while.
Or maybe MikroTik paid us to leak that information, right? To get that out there into the media. Maybe that's what it was. Wink.
That,
hey, we're getting that sweet commission money, right? 0.001% of all MikroTik sales? Man, I would go for that.
I would go for that, too. Oh, shit.
I guess kind of a tangent off of that. We're still looking for anybody that has an inside connection to Latvian mobile telecom. If anybody has a connection there, let us know so we can get our feature requests in.
Send it to their support. I gotcha. Oh man! While we're speaking about features, RouterOS version 7 Alpha 2 has been released, and they actually put it out for CHR. And the masses rejoice. So now you don't have to try and load it up on an ARM-based processor. You can actually load it in a CHR and start playing with it. The only thing I remember seeing in the changelog is that they exposed OSPF in WinBox. So I'm not sure what real features or advances have been put in there. But they're slowly adding stuff.
I think there's various like triple PoE fixes and some other things like that that weren't... people found pretty early.
I'm sure mostly client-based, right? Supporting the stuff they're doing with the Latvian telecom.
I see there's three PPP feature, fixes, CapsMan, IPsec, and then other, which, yeah.
No, it's at least nice to see that they are actually working on it, and that we are getting constant releases of the V7 alpha. That's always encouraging, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Is it 16 days from beta 1 to beta 2? So that's not too bad.
No, that's quite amazing, right? Because on the forums they were very very careful about it, saying we have no like ETAs. Another release will come when it will come, who knows what will be in it and stuff like that. Like, who knows? You would imagine that MikroTik knows, right? But so it's really nice to see that it wasn't just like a one-off, here's a V7 release and yay, now let the unicorn lie sleeping for another couple of months, So it's very nice to see that they are actually actively releasing in the V7 branch. And
so what do you think... What do you think the big secrecy is about on the release schedule? Do you think they just don't want to miss a milestone and then have people bitch and moan?
I think they are just being careful about managing expectations, right?
Yeah, because, anybody who's had any V7 expectations have already been shattered once. Either being careful to not have somebody set a new one that then gets broken. They've never made any promises about it at all. People just kind of kept berating them for it.
I mean, I think they made quite a few promises in support tickets with the, it will be fixed in version 7.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure, yeah.
I think that's where a lot of the pressure has come from. Yeah, fixed in version 7, so people are like, all right, well, when is that? Okay.
Well, sure, yeah. Yeah, like, this will be fixed then. We're just not telling you when. I've got many things, several things that, I've completely moved on from deployment strategies of things I asked about that were going to be coming in version 7. Like, I've already moved on to something else.
Oh, so, for example, as a very good example, I think, one of the things which doesn't currently work in RouterOS, which is completely broken, is OSPF with IPv6 with /128. Right, there is a long-standing bug with redistribution of 128 in OSPF v3 for IPv6, which MikroTik have stated multiple times that it will be fixed in version 7. Right, which is a very good example, and I am there is a huge forum thread about this, about issues with OSPFv3 in version 5 and version 6, of course, right? So as soon as version 7 OSPF is available, right, if that feature is not fixed in there, there will be a lot of angry people on the forums, in support tickets, etc., right? So, and that's just one example out of probably thousands.
You can almost hear them sharpening their pitchforks now, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, there will be, you know, rebel, right? So, I think they are just being careful, managing expectations and working on it on the back end. In the end, it's software development, right? It takes time. It's not always easy. And
I would say people would know about that, right?
Oh, yeah. And when you have a fan base which is as enthusiastic as MyCritics is, you know, you want to be careful not to overpromise and underdeliver. That's, you never want to do that, right?
Right.
Yet I was looking at my email, and I think the earliest version 7 promise I got from MikroTik was August of 2015, as in this feature will be in version 7. So it's they got some time to go, I suppose.
Well, work in progress. It'll be like Duke Nukem Forever, right? It'll be amazing when it comes out.
Yeah, sure. We all know how that turns out.
On that OSPF comment, one of the changes in Beta 2 was Winbox re-adding OSPF menu.
Yeah, there you go.
So then I would assume that OSPF is there if it's in the menu.
If it actually works, it might be in the menu, but you might not be able to configure it. I haven't tested beta too.
Yeah, I haven't even touched the alpha yet. Since there's so many pieces missing. But I guess, you know, they want people to probe around, right, to help find the bug. So I guess maybe we should be kind of poking at it. I just don't really have a lot of time right now.
Yep, time is non-existent.
Yeah.
Because on the beta 1, the only things that it says are not available are BGP MPLS, extra packages, which I don't know what qualifies as an extra package.
The dude.
And that, well, yeah, that's fine.
things like NTP.
That's probably for the better. And then Winbox does not show all features. Use CLI for most functionality.
Well, there you go.
So whatever's not in an extra package, not BGP MPLS, should be there. It just, yeah, you know, I have no time to do all of the regular work that I have, much less more.
That's all right. I'll leave it up to everybody else. Some of the little brothers have already started poking around with it, so they can give us the update once they find something neat, I suppose. So while we're on the MikroTik train, let's hit a few other things. So Colin was asking about 802.3AD, which is LACP, which is a bonding protocol, right, where you can bond multiple physical interfaces into a single logical. It gives you better redundancy, more throughput. And he was talking about how to distribute traffic. And it all comes down to your transmit hashing, right? And I think the key word there is transmit. You can only control how it leaves the bond, right? And so the hashing basically determines how it's going to divide up traffic, right? And so I'm sure Thomas is going to, he's cringing while I'm talking now, and he'll fix whatever I say here in a moment. But it's a mixture of layer 2, right, which is like MAC addresses, so you can kind of determine your hash. And it's vendor dependent, right? So everybody does a little bit differently. And then even hardware models do it differently. MikroTik, it could be mostly the same, I guess, across the board. But it'll be like layer 2, so you can do it based on MAC addresses, or you can do it based on IP addresses, or TCP UDP ports, right? So I think if you want kind of the best division of traffic, what would you go with? Layer 3, layer 4 hashing, which is going to be IP and port based, so it'll kind of mix up your, although, right, it's no guarantee of actually balanced traffic. It's just going to be more or less balancing connections, I guess, in that respect, right?
So yeah, it just depends on how how granular you want the traffic to be divided, which of course doesn't guarantee anything, because if there is one stream that's, you know, utilizing the full link, and then another stream gets the same hash reminder, it will be put on the same link, and, you know, they will there will be congestion because the other link is not utilized. So how the hashing actually works on the technical level, right? You take the fields from the frame, from the Ethernet frame. You take the fields that you that you specified as the hashing policy, and then there is an algorithm which is run on it, and it results in a hash. And if you have two links, right, you divide it by two, and there is only two options. There is no remainder, or remainder is one. And then depending on that, it gets basically on the remainder of the division of the hash, it gets put on a link, right, with that particular link index. And so to make the technical complicated thing simple, for example, if you select MAC address based hashing, which is layer 2 hashing, then a single host, a single MAC address will ever only utilize one link. So to fully utilize the bond, you need to have at least as many unique hosts communicating as you have members links in the bond. So yeah, if you select layer 4 hashing, which is either the TCP or UDP port numbers, or for different protocols that don't have ports, there is different things which the hashing algorithm can use, like tunnel IDs for GRE and different things. Basically, there is a very good chance that each connection, it would be connection based, would get put on its separate link. The one thing which people, which usually surprises people, is that, yeah, you only control transmit, and but also the hashing policy can be different on both ends of the link. There is no LHCP, LACP as a protocol. It doesn't really negotiate hashing across the link. It just negotiates, you know, for it to be basically for the link to behave as a single link from a macro perspective. So there will be no loops, there will be no issues with spanning tree. And actually, funny story, we can do a little tangent. Back about, I would say maybe 10 years ago at this point, we bought some ZISO switches, and these were, at the time, this was 10 years ago, right? But at the time, those were quite expensive data center grade ZISO switches, which is funny to say, you know, ZISO and data center in the same sentence, but this was 10 years ago. And so we bought about, I think it was about, it was about 5,000 euros worth of switches, which this doesn't translate well because it was 10 years ago and euros versus dollars. It was a lot of money at that time,
right,
of switches. And we connected it all up. It was a very heavily meshed network on layer 2, I mean. So there was a lot of redundant connections, and there was, of course, spanning tree. And spanning tree was running across the LACP bonds. And surprise, surprise, they had a bug in the firmware where spanning tree would treat individuals members of a bond as spanning tree links. So spanning tree would shut down links inside of an LACP bond.
Awesome.
Yeah, so we actually, it was funny, we actually, like, this bug went through months of solving. It went all the way to Taiwan, and they promised to fix it, and they didn't, and then we returned the switches, and they gave us back the money. But this is exactly what LACP, and since then I have never bought any Zyxel equipment ever. No, I mean literally, in 10 years since that incident, I have not bought a single piece of Zyxel equipment. But the point is, or the moral of the story is that this is the job of LACP. It's from the macro perspective to make sure that the bond behaves as a single link for the rest of the network. But inside of the bond, how the traffic is distributed, LACP doesn't really control. So each end can use a different hashing policy, and each end can, well, split traffic, you know, according to their own rules. And so why this is important is when you are doing cross-vendor LACP, for example, right? You don't really have to care, or you don't even have to know, because most of the vendors, they don't give you a way to configure the hashing policy. So you just enable bonding, you throw in links to a bond, and it just works, and you like, you don't even know what they are doing at the back, yeah. You know, what hashing policy they are doing, and you can't configure it. And then you test, and you are hoping, you know, yay, I'll get 2 or 3 or 5 gigabit over the link, and you test, and then you are disappointed because you find out they just do layer 2 hashing, right?
Yeah, yeah. So for MikroTik, I've never had two different vendors have the same options for hashing, like all the same options. Usually you're going to have to compromise on one side or the other on what you actually want, it seems like.
Oh, I mean... That's the beauty of it not being, you know, there is no requirement of it being the same on both sides, right? You can choose the best available hashing on each side. So right. In the MikroTik, right, you can just do layer 4 hashing and you're a happy camper, and then whatever is on the other side, it will do what's, well, whatever it does, right? So this, of course, creates all the possible issues you have with multi-link communication and with asymmetric traffic flow, right? So any asymmetry, however you pronounce that.
Yeah, yeah.
Any asymmetry on any layer, be that layer 2 or layer 3, can cause potential issues. So yeah, there is potential issues when you are doing different hashing algorithms on both sides of the link for, you know, out of order packet delivery or asymmetric traffic flows, but usually on layer 2 it's not much of an issue, and usually it just works.
Yeah, so for me, what I've seen before is a lot of cheaper switches seem to only do layer 2 hashing, right, based on MAC addresses. So if in theory you've got, say, a border router that's connecting to the internet, and then you've got an internal router, and you've got a bond between those two, and then you've got internet users beyond there, all of the traffic between those two bonded interfaces is always going to use the same one NIC, right? Because it's sourced from the same MAC address, and it's going to the same MAC. So it's sourced from the router's.
It will do literally nothing.
And it's going to the next router's MAC address. So in theory, the hashing is only going one. It's taking one pipe. So, you know, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to hash. I'm going to get to all of these internet users are going to be able to evenly distribute, right? But if you're stuck at layer 2 and it's just going from router to router, that's one link. That's one connection. You still have redundancy, right? So if you've got two connections, if you've got two physical interfaces and one fails, well, I mean, everything's going to fail over to the other one. So you've still got redundancy, right? But you don't get the added benefit of, I guess, additional bandwidth or additional throughput going through that pipe. So that's when it can kind of be important to make sure that you're in, like, in a weird scenario, like, not that that's that weird a scenario, but in a scenario like that, it's important to know that your equipment's capable of higher layer hashing protocols if you want to, you know, kind of more evenly distribute that traffic and stuff. And I've seen people run into that so many times where they just, it's like,
oh, sure,
it's like, it just totally isn't working the way I expected.
But that you don't need, like, the device does not have to be participating in the given layer in the hashing. So, like, it doesn't have to be a layer 3 device to participate in layer 3 hashing. You know, you can have a switch that has no layer 3 functionality in terms of the forwarding plane that still does layer 3 hashing, because it's just an inspection of the packet. It's not needing to do more. I've had people, several people actually, that thought that.
Yeah, I suppose LACP is just one of those protocols where it's, you know, usually you don't see under the hood in any, like, GUI-driven configuration. Of course, MikroTik is different, but
yeah.
Speaking about, you know, other vendors and switches that are web interface driven, you know, you just enable OCP, put in some links into it, and there, it's done, right? So it creates this, like, an idea or this mythos that it's just, yeah, click a couple of buttons and it will be load balancing and failover and everything will just work. And it's one of those examples where it really pays off to know the back end of the technology and how it works, because then you actually understand what's happening on the back end. And, well, first of all, you can make more informed decisions when buying equipment, and second of all, you know, when you run into issues like this, you will hopefully know why it's behaving the way it's behaving and how to better configure it to behave better in your particular use case.
You know, while I'm thinking about this, another little side tangent, and I'm just going to get your temperature and see what you think, Thomas. I think you'll probably back my play here, but I was looking at some, you know, because I've been doing like this wireless LAN controller thing on Cisco, and they were talking about doing a bond, or I mean, Cisco calls it Ether channel. So they're talking about doing an Ether channel, and they were saying to manually turn it on. So, well, you know, it's like you can force on a bond, and it's not using a dynamic protocol. And I was thinking, why in the world would they do that when there's, you know, it's so easy for them to implement LACP. And I mean, I'm sure it's Linux under the hood and that's built in already. Why not just use that? Because I try, and when I'm doing an Ether channel or a bond, I try and never make it a manual on bond, because when you do that, it's not using any dynamic protocol. It just forces the ports on. And when you actually do like LACP, it negotiates over those ports, and it's making sure that that other neighbor is alive and operating the way it expects it to. And if that negotiation fails at any point in the process, it pulls it out of the bond, right? Whereas if you have a forced on manual bonding and an interface is gone screwy, the other side has no idea about it, right? And it just stays on and black holes traffic.
Usually vendors call this a static bond.
There you go, static.
Right? Versus LACP. So when you have some cheap, well, not cheap, but you know, web UI driven switches, they call it static bonding. And yeah, it's a bad idea. Always a bad idea. Like, I've seen many different issues with. We use LACP quite a bit, right? It's a very useful protocol, it's a very useful piece of technology. And we use it quite a bit. And I've seen many issues where, yeah, just either the software on the device, just, you know, something goes wrong, or cross vendor compatibility issues. I've seen some of those as well. And so, yeah, it's never a good idea to use static bonding, right? Yeah. Always use LACP. And
I saw somebody using static bonding with media converters, and the fiber went down, but the port was still up for the media converter.
Oh, that's fun.
Oh, yeah. So all of the traffic trying to go out that static bond was just disappearing, just falling off the face of the earth.
That's one thing which we should probably mention. If you are doing any kind of bonding, it's a point-to-point protocol, right? You should not have any devices between, like in the middle of the bonded link, right? It should be device to device. There shouldn't be any like wireless links or unmanaged switches or media converters or anything else in the middle of the bond. That's just asking for trouble.
So then what about, okay, so all these talked about bonding, what about James?
I have no idea.
And the crowd stays quiet.
I try. That guy's a dick. No, what's James? Is that another protocol or something?
James bonding.
Oh, Jesus. Oh. I thought James was like some new bonding protocol that I just had no idea about. Making me feel stupid yet again because I can't keep up with technology. Appreciate that. That was terrible. You're an awful human being. I will mail you a worst human award shortly, Mike. So while we're talking about MikroTik and we're bagging on stuff, somebody was asking about the CSS. And yes, it runs SwitchOS. And no, I don't really run any in production. I've got one in my lab. But they were trying to do...
And no, you shouldn't... By you, I am referencing to the listeners here. You shouldn't run any in production either.
At least not in like a super important part of your network. They were trying to do port security. Or at least that's what Cisco calls it. I'm not sure what everybody else calls it. Like MAC protection or whatever. So the idea is there's an option called lock on first. So when your first device connects, it'll lock that MAC address into the port and it won't let any new MACs being learned on that port. And most vendors, most managed switches that I've ever worked on, that's a variable field, right? So I can say, well, the first 5 or the first 8 or the first 10, or I can actually do timeouts on how long the MAC is learned for. So it's learned for 5 minutes, and then, you know, it'll refresh, and if it's the same MAC, it sticks with it, right? So, or whatever. But it seems the CSS is, once you turn lock on first, The only way for it to clear that is to turn lock on first off and then back on, or reboot the switch. So you don't really have any.
Not even when the port goes down.
He said he tested. I'm not sure how long he left the port down for, but he said it didn't clear it out.
So, actually, since we are on this topic, well, first of all, forget CSS, right? Those things should. I'm sorry, MikroTik, CSS and SwitchOS should not exist. But speaking of layer 2 security, actually, what I would really like to see in RouterOS on the layer 2 side is the same layer 2 security that Cisco does with dynamic ARP inspection, yeah, and, you know, actually tying in DHCP snooping to port security. So, I would love to see that in RouterOS. I mean, there are already tools, like you can limit the number of MAC addresses on a port, you can enable DHCP snooping, but there is no like dynamic ARP inspection, and there is no interplay between DHCP snooping and the ARP inspection and the locking of the port to a particular MAC address. So I'll let you explain, Greg, how that works in Cisco, because I don't want to monologue for too long, but no, I would love MikroTik C do it the same way. It just makes sense. It's very functional. It's a great piece of security.
Yeah.
And can we have that, please?
Yeah, so what Thomas is referring to is in Cisco, you can turn on DHCP snooping, wherein a port, it's a method for access ports not to be able to act as rogue DHCP servers, right? So only the DHCP servers on the network that you're anticipating. So a person will come up on a port and they'll ask for a DHCP address that will be allowed through. And then when it's handed back to the client and they accept it, it's stored in the DHCP snooping binding table, which I have no idea why they made it so long and complex. But it's stored in that table. And then you can actually start Lego brick snapping other security things on top of that, which Thomas referenced was dynamic ARP inspection. So if you're doing DHCP snooping, you can also turn on dynamic ARP inspection, which says, hey, unless they're in the snooping binding table, don't let them communicate out of that port. So unless somebody pulls an IP via DHCP, they can't have a MAC address come out of that interface. So that's going to prevent people from, say, trying to do layer 2, ARP poisoning or spoofing man-in-the-middle stuff. I mean, it cuts out just a ton of different security features.
Or even using static addresses, right? It forces you to use DHCP.
DHCP.
Therefore, it also forces you to, or prevents you from using a static address and taking somebody else's.
Yeah, for sure. So
sorry for jumping in there.
No, it's a great security feature. You were talking about it, and I was thinking about how the CRS 300 series is the first one that has DHCP snooping in hardware. So since they're actually storing that in the chipset, I don't know. Man, I don't know. Do you think that's available that they can just go in there and pluck it and add it to other things? I know they added the DHCP snooping option to all of the MikroTik. It's just going to do it in software, so it's going to be less efficient theoretically. So like
honestly, I don't think it matters if it's in hardware or software either, because if you think about it, it's just an interplay between two features that are already available in RouterOS, right? You have the ability to limit MAC addresses, you have the ability to control the ARP to IP address binding table, and you have DHCP snooping. Right. I don't think it really matters if it's software or hardware. You just have to make that interplay between the features happen and expose it to the user to configure it, and that's it, right?
Yeah, I don't use snooping on anything except for the 300 series, because it turns off the hardware switching if you turn on snooping.
I don't have anything other than the 300 series before that.
There you
CRS
go.
Was on our no purchase list since the 300 series.
Yeah, so if you do it on anything else, it actually turns off hardware forwarding on the switching stuff. If you turn on DHCP snooping, that's where I'm always kind of like, I don't really want to do that. I don't want to turn on snooping on anything but the 300, because you take a pretty big hit on performance.
Well, I mean, realistically, anything other than the 300 series is. I mean, I'm sorry, MikroTik, but you know, I voiced this before, it's really unusable, right? You are missing so many features. You don't have even the new way of configuring VLANs, right? On 2 and 1 series, you still have to do the switch VLAN configuration, which is just horrible, right? Otherwise, you lose hardware acceleration, right? And of course, there is all the other stuff like spanning tree. even spending 3 on CRS1 would disable hardware acceleration, right? And so realistically, yeah, it's just a bad idea to run those devices in your network, because doing anything to them, you know, putting any configuration on the switch chip disables hardware acceleration. And these are essential basic things which every network should have, right? You know, spanning tree, essential. If somebody can just connect two cables and cause the network to go down, it's just stupid not to protect against that, right? And that's not even speaking about security, like DHCP snooping and, you know, ARP and a sane way of configuring VLANs and other stuff, right? It's just basics that need to be present, which now are in CRS version 3, which is great, and which is why I personally use them as well. But I think getting back to the topic, doing things like dynamic ARP inspection and basically more of the layer 2 stuff is easily within the powers of MikroTik. I just don't know if it's their focus right now, right? We know that they probably, what they are focusing on is getting version 7 out, or at least it seems that way, mm-hmm. which is definitely a right move that needs to happen. And also, it's hard for me to say from the business side if it's, you know, how they want to steer their business, if the layer 2 side is, you know, is big enough yet, or if they even want to move the layer 2 side more into the security and enterprise environment where things like this are needed, as compared to an telco, ISP, WISP environment. But I would definitely love to see things like that in RouterOS.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see some features like that. I mean, I've heard people before say, well, if we add this feature, how much more money is that going to make us, right? And that's a crystal ball that I can't look into and divine any. I'm looking at the tea leaves, and I don't know one way or the other. But I think if you ask anybody in the enterprise environment, especially where they have networks that don't, you know, where they don't really necessarily trust their users, which should be all enterprises, it's a feature that I run in most of my office environments and stuff like that, and it's extremely usable in enterprise. And I see them picking up a lot more, especially with the 300 series CRSs, just because they have so many features, you know, and they're really starting to get solid. As you said, it's got the Thomas stamp of approval. You will actually use them in production networks. So it's, I think they're heading in the right direction with it for sure.
Oh, I definitely agree. Yeah. It's a full grade, full featured, serious product now, whereas before it wasn't. So I mean, that's, you know, they are definitely moving in the right direction. Yeah,
that's awesome. Let's see, we had Chad the other day pop in the Slack on the MikroTik area, and he was talking about how he's running 644.5, which is long term, and he was having some random reboots on his router. He's doing bonding and then also BGP and OSPF, and he just couldn't divine what was going on. He asked MikroTik, you know, he sent him the sup out and all that stuff, and they said that it might be a bonding issue, because they did just recently fix one in 6.45, and so it may be related to that. So if you are running bonding and you're having random reboots, that might be why. So just kind of a heads up on that stuff. Sometimes stuff like that, you know, I guess, you know, when you hit a bug, man, that's the most confounding, especially when you're trying to run like a long term, right? It's like, I don't want to jump my border router up to this brand new version when I know I've got everything else working in here. Although that's a pretty major problem if you're having random reboots. So stay on the lookout for that. All right. So Jeremy, the Australian, the guy from Perth, he was asking about notification systems. So several came up. I know PagerDuty, everybody's heard of PagerDuty, OpsGenie, and I think Alex particularly likes OpsGenie. Simon, I want to say, said VictorOps. And I've always just done kind of, and somebody else said they've done this too, is email notifications to SMS gateways, right? Where you send an email and it sends you a text or whatever. But to be honest with you, we've got a 24/7 knock with a person that's always, we actually have two of them, with human beings that are awake looking at notifications, and they make phone calls to people. So I've never actually had to really do one of these other than the email to SMS thing. Have you guys had any experience with doing any of these? Have you thought about doing any of these?
So it Oh, sorry, go ahead. You're going to have something more useful to say.
Go ahead. I've talked a bunch already.
I haven't done a lot. I know that that there are some mining systems that have plugins for these for different services. And I've never quite settled on what it was that I wanted to do. SMS is fairly universal, but it has, there's no guarantee that the message is actually delivered. And then it has a fairly rudimentary system for doing the acknowledgments and things like that. So that's where something dedicated, like an app on a phone, which I think PagerDuty and OpsGenie have, probably wrong, but somebody does. And so, that certainly has a lot of benefit when the texts that have or have not seen the notification and if they've acknowledged it and so on. If you do SMS, I think the email to SMS is probably the worst way of doing it because email to SMS gateways have, there's no guarantee, there's rate limiting, there's all these other things on there because it's just a free bonus. Service. You would need to work with a provider that actually has a real SMS gateway. If you wanted to use SMS.
Yeah.
And I think some of these services have those integrations as well.
Yeah, and I think these other services like PagerDuty and OpsGenie, I think they also have the option where, if you've got a rotating schedule of who's on call, I think you can actually put that in there. And so it'll automatically, this next week, on Monday, starting at midnight, Tom's on duty, and then when it rolls over the next week, all right, now it's John, he's on duty, and so it kind of automatically takes care of that for you. And I think you're right. I think most of them also have kind of accountability systems, right? So if a notification goes out, you have to go in there and acknowledge it, otherwise it keeps attempting to notify, right? Something like that.
Yeah. And I suppose that with those scheduling type things, I assume there's also some sort of override thing where it's like, if Bob hasn't responded in an hour, you need to go bother somebody else because Bob's passed out drunk or whatever.
Bob, can't trust him. What's your experience with these things, Thomas?
So we used to do like a bunch of things. Yeah, back in the day we used to do like email to SMS, then we migrated to a service, so you just do an API call, HTTPS call, and it's by call I mean of course HTTP request, and it fires an SMS, right? Just an API SMS gateway and all of this stuff, and we don't use any of that anymore because Slack exists. So now we route everything into Slack, and there is a Slack bot, and it takes care of all of this. So it will do all of those things, like notifying the right people depending on schedule. You have to acknowledge it, otherwise it bothers. There is escalation. We've pretty much unified all of our messaging and like all of our notifications into Slack. Even Pushover, which I loved, and I've used Pushover for a long time, and I've unified like all of my, it used to be that all of my like RSS notifications and change notifications from websites and interesting stuff and subscriptions, etc., it would all go into Pushover before Slack was a thing. I spent a lot of work on that, and I loved it because you have a single place where you have all of your notifications, all of your interesting stuff, right? And so now for me personally, I've moved all of that from Pushover to Slack, and also for the company and the job stuff, we've also unified all messaging, all alerting, basically everything is in Slack.
How many people do you have in your company Slack?
I think 13, 14.
That's not too bad. Then you do the pay version?
No, still on free.
Oh, nice.
So then have you developed the all of the intelligence behind that Slack notification system then? Or are you relying on some third-party intelligence that just ties into your Slack?
Yeah, it's just a integration into our Slack.
Okay. Yeah, because you do a lot more development type things than most people are capable of. So I figured, you know, you're like, oh, you know, it only takes 6 hours to whip this up, so I'll just do it myself. Or something like that.
Right.
You know.
How much does it take an actual human to do that? Yeah, I get it. Not Robot Thomas.
No, it's just an integration into Slack. Like, we've moved, as I said, we've moved like stuff like failed builds from our CI/CD system. Continuous integration, basically. Anytime we do any change in Unimess, it runs all the tests and stuff like that. If that fails, it actually notifies the person that was inside of the change set of the code through Slack that a build failed. Ticketing we do through Slack, like somebody moves a ticket from, you know, it finished development, it needs review and testing, it notifies the person in Slack, like, you know, alarms from NetXMS and you know, notifications from external monitoring. Like I said, we've unified everything into Slack, and I know I'm fairly happy with it.
So what's the robot you use to do all that stuff?
Which one?
In Slack.
Oh, it's different ones for, there is a different one for the CI/CD integration, there is a different one for ticketing system, there is a different one for NetXMS notifications, so it's just a bunch of integrations, a bunch of robots, yeah, that integrate into our Slack workspace, and each one takes care of the appropriate thing.
Very nice. I'd also like to point out that earlier, Thomas didn't deny that he was a robot, so I'll leave that up to your imagination.
Hey man, same as before. I can't deny nor confirm anything.
He's more machine than man, for sure. So tell us about NetXMS 3.
So this must be that neural net stuff that Musk is talking about. Really?
Yeah.
Really, it's a Slovakian.
Man, as soon as that stuff, the Neuralink stuff, as soon as that's like commercial ready, I'm all in for testing it. As soon as they don't have to actually penetrate my skull.
Right, no implants.
That's what I mean
by,
yeah, that's what I mean by production ready. You know, when it's like an actual product that you just put on your head, I'm all in.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think one piece is good where it can actually read and understand what you're thinking, but how's it going to jam thoughts into your brain? That's what I want.
I think maybe I've talked about this before. There is an amazing article on the Wait But Why blog. I think I've thought about Wait But Why before. There is an amazing, amazing 20-page article about Neuralink, about how actually brain-machine interfaces, BMIs, it's what they're called, brain-machine interfaces work. And, you know, how actually scanning and interacting with human neural networks and neurons works. And if somebody is interested in all of this, and it makes some very good and interesting predictions for the future. For example, it tells you why we already are cyborgs, even today. And if we have time, maybe we can get onto that tangent as well. But it's a really good article. It is serious, 20 pages, and it's a serious, in-depth article. But waitbutwhy.com, the future of the brain and Neuralink, the article is called. It's an amazing read.
All right, sweet action. Well, tell us about NetXMS 3, Thomas.
Yeah, NetXMS 3.0 is out.
Should we all run and upgrade?
Yeah, moving on. Yeah, so there's already been 3 hotfixes to 3.0. At this point, after the 3 hotfixes, it's actually all the reports that I'm hearing and seeing, it's actually fairly stable and it works well. There's been changes, so you should definitely read the changelog and all of that. There is still some kinks with some very specific use cases, specifically the node runtime flags have completely changed in 3.0. Well, not completely. They have changed in 3.0. They work differently. So if you are using runtime flags in your NXSL scripts in NetXMS and you upgrade to 3.0, it's quite likely it will break or it will behave differently. So that's one thing which we are not sure what they're going to do with it yet, because they made the change for a reason, but it turns out it broke some very specific people's setups. But otherwise, 3.0 is, yeah, it's after the hotfixes, so at this point it's stable, it works great, there is really nice new features. One of those actually is that you can now have multiple proxies per zone, and NetXMS will completely automatically balance the collection between the proxies inside of a zone. So it actually actively looks at stuff like data collection queue, CPU load, memory load of each proxy configured for the zone, and the server schedules data collection to different proxies depending on load, collection queue, and things like that. So it provides automatic load balancing and failover for zone proxies, which at the same time, and it's you just enable it and it just works, and it's really nice.
It so in there you said about reading the changelog. So if you don't normally read a changelog, is this where you should start, or can you just kind of?
I would say you should normally read the changelog of stuff that you upgrade, right?
Yeah, but Mike's not about that life.
Yeah.
Yeah, who has time for that, right?
No, nobody. I'm busy reading about Neuralinks. I don't have time for changelogs.
Yeah, nobody got time for that.
I'm not reading. Actually, I started two months ago, started watching the Joe Rogan podcast, and it's just playing in the background as he talks to Elon Musk and Neil deGrasse Tyson and all these other people.
So you think you're absorbing it by osmosis? Just kind of seeping
in? I mean, I'm talking about it now, so apparently something seeped in.
I try not to do that with podcasts I actually care about, because as I'm like focusing on something, everything else just kind of goes away, and so I'll miss big giant chunks of what was going on if I do that.
Yeah, that's probably happened.
Hmm.
But you know, versus just listening to nothing or music, you know, I got some sort of intellectual stimulation.
Oh, fair enough. As long as you're stimulated, we're all happy. So while you're stimulated, Mike's going to complain about some stuff. I'm going to hit you with what? What do you get, a minute and a half to complain? Because we got to put a limit on how much whining you actually get to do on this one.
I don't know if I could even complain about the minute and a half complaint in a minute and a half.
Let's see what you can do. You want to complain about municipalities and fiber.
And the clock starts now.
All right.
As many may know, I've been starting to build out fiber lately. And things are a lot easier in the U.S. if you are certified as a CLEC, a competitive local exchange carrier. It's a carryover from the phone days, from the Telecom Act of 96. And yes, it makes you regulated and stuff, and some people choose to spin that off into a separate company to kind of separate regulatory domains. But the FCC and often states have very specific benefits that you can use. You know, if you're just Joe Blow a Wisp and you want to go use a right-of-way, the city or whatever can tell you whatever they want, and you have to take it because you have no entitlement.
Take a hike.
If you are a CLEC at the federal level, they say that everything must be, I forget the exact language, but you know, neutral and non-discriminatory. So whatever the incumbent phone company has for an agreement, you can't have a worse agreement. I mean, certainly you can negotiate a better one, because then that's at the phone company's disadvantage, but you can't be any worse off than anybody else. And then, you know, each states are going to have different things. You know, Illinois has various restrictions as to what they can do. But because you have a right, means that now you have to defend said rights. And that's not always easy if somebody wants to do something else. We've got a particular municipality that has obscene requirements. I've been talking to them since October. of last year. So we're talking about 11 and a half months I've been talking to this entity. They still have yet to issue a construction permit. I had to send our crews away because the city hadn't issued the permit yet. And they're just asking for all kinds of things that are just... You can't do, but
they ask you to bring in the shrubbery.
Well, you know that may be easier.
Yeah.
But like the incumbent phone company in this town, their contract with the city expired 9 years ago, so the non-discriminatory requirement would be that we don't have any agreement. However, I want to build today. The city's not willing to let me build today without an agreement.
Gotcha. So they're dragging their feet. Is that what it comes down to?
And so, here I am. Okay, so now I guess we're going to have an agreement, despite the fact that they can't require me to have one. I'm not prepared to invest the time to defend that right. They require all kinds of stuff of us that they haven't required in other agreements. So we're trying to mitigate some of that. One of the things that was required of us was that we must maintain 5-foot horizontal and 2-foot vertical separation from all water, sewer, and private services at all times.
That's pretty damn tough.
Well,
especially if you're
it's
going
impossible
to an existing easement, then it's going to be full of that stuff.
Well, see, but it's impossible because the moment you reach the next street,
right, you're going to have
or
to
next
cross
easement,
that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So they wanted 5-foot horizontal separation from all their utilities. Well, you can't do that and escape the box into the next block. And it's just, because they're like, well, you know, they're trying to charge us for stuff they can't charge. It's just very difficult. So while I push that you should be a CLEC if you're building fiber, be prepared that if you're going to defend your rights, you may not wish to spend the time doing so, and it may only end up getting you a better position rather than the position you should have.
Sounds like you need to make friends with people at the city. Like you could maybe make things a little bit easier on yourself if you did.
Well, see, the problems with people at cities is that they're kind of like people in HOAs. They are people that were probably made fun of in high school and are, and have had some sort of, they have some sort of inferiority complex, and now they get to flex their muscle on, in these limited situations. And it's like, well, you either do what he wants or spend a whole bunch of time fighting. And so there's a lot of it was just like, well, we just have to have this. And it's like, in the FCC language, they have, there have been court cases where, like, the city of New York was trying to restrict this company from payphone deployments. Well, payphones are a regulated telecom service, and the FCC, had decided that the limit on payphones prevented this other company from entering the market. And so while there was not a specific, prohibition, it was a de facto moratorium on new builds. And so, the FCC or the court, whichever one it was in this particular case, declared that the city was wrong and that they had to allow this to build. And, saying that, you can't make the requirement so stringent that somebody cannot build. They can't require these sort of separation requirements because it's effectively preventing you from building. So as much as the city guy wants to beat his you know, chest about it, you know, the city attorney kind of sees the, well, you know, the FCC has already said, too bad, we don't care about what you want to regulate. You know, you can't prevent people from doing it. But to kind of circle back, all this is only if you're a CLEC. If you're just a WISP that's wanting to build, you don't have any of that protection. So,
yeah, well, protection's good, but you still have to have legal representation, which means that's going to cost you money, and you still have to engage these people. But at least you can get it done, even if they're being obtuse about it. I know we've been working in the community for a long time. I've tried to make friends with as many people in the city, both sides of the city, because Bryan College Station, actually, it's, I mean, they're two separate, but you'd think they're one big city, but... you know, and just helping those guys out as much as possible. And sometimes you can do joint projects together, right, just to cement those relationships. But in the end, sometimes stuff just comes down to politics and there's nothing I can do about it. But having said that, we also have a sister company that's a CLEC as well, so we can push through if we need to.
Sure, yeah, and that's, you know, and it, you know, it's not the end-all be-all, but you know, it's a tool that will make your life easier. And you don't have to have an attorney do everything. If you find enough to be able to read the read the laws yourself, you know, you can get a good basis for what your protections are, and then, you know, work within yourself once, you know, to your own limit, you know. If they keep pushing, you know, then you'll have to reach out to someone more intelligent to do some more digging up, like, you know, prior case law and stuff. Because usually attorneys will, you know, you show them comparable case law, and, you know, they'll back off pretty quick. But, you know, that you'll need somebody else for, because most of us don't know how to find that. But the law is pretty easy to find in most areas.
For sure. All right, man. Well, that was 10 minutes, Mike. What do you have to say for yourself?
I mean, I could very easily make that 30.
Is that a threat? Are you threatening me right now? That's what it feels like.
I mean, you know, I could go on about, you know, they had the requirement of us without providing us where their infrastructure was. We had to be 5 feet away, but they wouldn't tell you where it was. Uh-huh.
Such as life.
Despite
that's the city. We've done in those situations is we call in a dig test, and they have to come out and mark. So you find out really quick where everybody is.
Our state's location service has a design stage request where, you know, where the utilities don't actually dispatch anybody to physically mark. They just coordinate maps and stuff so that you can do the best design you can, you know, before you actually build. And I put that through May 22nd for this town, and they responded Wednesday.
Good. That's record speed for municipalities.
So you know, 4 months and some change. But then, you know, they were said, you know, private services. I'm like, well, do you mean like the water connection to the house, or do you mean all utilities? Because you can't compel a private company to provide you that mapping information, because in our state, that design stage is optional. Hmm. I'm like, so then how are you going to make me do that? It's like, unless you're going to give me their data, you can't make me do that. But, and so, you know, I've been spending a whole bunch of time now re-engineering the network because they couldn't be bothered to tell me what they wanted until, you know, crunch time. They couldn't be bothered to tell me everything it was. So I've redesigned this 20-mile fiber network, 3/4 of it, twice. And I'm in the process of doing it again.
Okay. That's why you're so busy. It's all this duplication of effort.
Yeah, and, you know, digging through state law and, you know, this clause says we can't have this and can't have, you know, we're entitled to that.
Yeah. If there were only people you could pay to do these sorts of things.
Well, and so some of this, so this year, see now, you had to bring up the whole 10 minutes, and now here I am, we're probably going to go for another 5 or 10.
Yeah, you're almost on time. Jesus.
Well, but I mean, I think a lot of this is stuff that, because building fiber is becoming, but you know, building fiber is becoming a topic of interest to many WISPs. And, you know, it's not like I'm talking about, you know, baking pies or anything, which would interest all of us.
Is that where you're going with Great British Bake Off? Because they did have pie in the last episode, and it was brilliant.
I guess as a tangent off of that, for the Filipinos paying attention to this, we celebrated my wife's birthday today, and you know, we're in Chicago, so nowhere near the Philippines, and I was able to get her an ube chiffon cake and sapin ice cream. That's can be very difficult to find. You know, I was talking to one Filipino I know, and he's like, I haven't even had that in 5 years. So that, we had that today.
Well, Chicago's a big area. It seems like you'd have some decent resources for stuff like that, right?
Well, right, which is why I was able to do it. But, like, this particular chain, they only have, like, a few locations in the U.S., period. And most of them in California. Mm. So it's like, you know, I don't think even if you're in New York, you could get it. I mean, probably from somebody else, but not from this chain.
Shots fired, bro.
But anyway, so where the hell was I now? Damn it.
I think you were all wrapped up.
No, like I had like 30 seconds left, and now we had to...
I'm just giving you hell.
The tangents lost it. Yes. I don't...
I killed it.
I had something that was going that was going to be useful to people about fiber in general. So when we first started doing this, we were getting quotes for $4, $5, $6 a foot for the engineering services. And I'm like, I'm looking to spend 10 to 12 altogether. And you want to give me half of that for just drawing a damn map? You know, go fly a kite. You know, I'll do that myself for at this current project was, you know, for $600,000, yeah, I'll just do that myself. Because there's no way I'll spend $600,000 worth of time doing it. And since then, this spring at WISP America, there was a guy I've known for 15 years that, you know, and I know that, you know, he's the fiber guy. And, you know, I just assumed that because he was this great guy that everybody knew and, you know, all, you know, this great resume that he was going to be crazy expensive. And he came back at a price that I can't say publicly, but I mean, it was
substantially less.
Substantially less, where I'm like, it's a slam dunk. Next year, he'll be doing all this.
Gotcha.
And, you know, and it's a thing where, like, you know, you hire an expert, he'll do it faster than you will. But, you know, if, you know, I gladly would have spent this year. You know, I spent more on handholds than I'm going to spend on this guy to do the engineering. So,
you know, something somebody told me a long time ago is they said, do what you're good at, and for everything else, find somebody to do it for a good price. And I've tried to live by that, and it has made my life so much happier and more efficient.
Oh, sure. And, like, you know, like, I've been trying to adopt that, and the first pricing I had just was not...
Yeah.
What's not good?
Just keep looking. You got there in the end.
But I didn't think to reach out to this guy just because I assumed he was expensive, and he wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Better stop assuming.
So, so don't just assume that something's expensive. Ask.
For sure, man. That's what my wife taught me a long time ago. You never know what you'll get till you ask. But she is like very. Bubbly personality when she wants to anyway, and she's very attractive and that kind of stuff works really well for her, less for me, but I've started doing that, and it is surprising if you just ask somebody, hey, Can you knock 5% off that? Okay. You know, hey, can we do this over here? Yeah, sure, why not? You know, just so long. I just try not to be unreasonable about stuff, and most people are cool with it.
And this guy, he thinks that he can probably save us money based on his his relationships with material suppliers and things like that. So it might actually cost us less to have him do the engineering than if we were to do it ourselves.
That's baller.
To kind of loop Tomas back in, are there people building their own fiber networks in Slovakia, or is it just, the incumbents and then WISPs?
Yeah, it's horrible. So pretty much every government organization has their own fiber network. Weird. Which is as stupid as it sounds. No, it's literally stupid. So there is a nationwide fiber network for the finance ministry, and that's it. Finance ministry uses it, but it's a nationwide fiber network.
What is that even? What is the finance ministry? What does that even mean?
We are really. You don't want to get me started.
All right, I was just curious. It's like, what's the US equivalent?
Super bureaucratic state, and basically they control, like, every single city has to have a connection to the finance ministry, and they have to submit paperwork and, like, wages, taxes, and ton of crap into it, and they have a fiber network of their own for that. The educational ministry has their own nationwide network, which connects all the schools, and it's a completely separate nationwide fiber network.
So, like, separate conduit in the ground and everything?
Yep. Oh, yes. And I am just getting started. So basically, yeah, they run, it's called SANET, Slovak Academic Network. And all the schools are connected into it, and yeah. Then the major carriers have their own fiber networks, of course. The major telcos, like... T-com and others that are here, Orange of course, and others. Then there is the energy industry. There is a incumbent state-owned energy company which runs their own fiber network, which is entirely separate from everything else. And then, of course, there is all the local WISPs and ISPs running their own fiber networks. And then, on top of all of this, usually each city has their own fiber network, which is completely separate from all of this that I've described before, and they don't lease it or anything like that. It's just completely stupid.
Yeah, so it sounds like you probably have more fiber than the United States, and and yet you can't use any of it.
Exactly. That is exactly what it is. It's stupid beyond belief. So you can't, like, lease transport through any of these networks. They're all purpose-built, single-purpose networks. Don't get me started on the money-wasting and political aspects of all of this. It's just really stupid.
Does Slovakia have a very thriving GDP and all that stuff where they can build these fiber networks?
sure. Yeah.
Okay.
We are definitely, the top 1% of the world, definitely.
I figured as much. Sure of that. Okay.
Yeah. So, it's just really stupid. It's a huge waste of money, and especially being a post-communistic middle European country where, wages and money are quite tight, it's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Does it fit into kind of the culture of the country and the way people think and act and all that stuff?
No, actually, that's the strange thing. It's just stupidity. It's not really a cultural thing or anything like that. It's just stupidity and government organizations not talking to each other and the legislature not being up to date yet, where cities can actually lease their fiber networks. It's just... There's no, like, even a reasonable explanation to this. It's just... a lack of government cooperation between government agencies and a lack of up-to-date legislature.
Weird. It is what it is, right?
Not much I can do about that.
For sure. All right, we are at the 1.5 hour mark. Do you guys want to add any final thoughts?
I've been sitting here trying to figure out how big Slovakia is compared to a U.S. state. It looks like
tiny.
Sits about in the middle of Massachusetts and like Ohio, like somewhere in the middle of that. I keep picking eastern states to see which one might be close, but I don't think there are any.
Yeah, it's what, 400 by 100 miles.
Oh wow, it's really small.
Yeah, it's tiny. 6 million people.
It's bigger than Maryland.
Yeah. Well, it's like what, 1/15 of Texas?
Oh, there we go. West Virginia. It's about the same size as West Virginia.
There you go.
So West Virginia, with maybe 2 fiber companies in the whole state, or, you know, networks. Slovakia's got seemingly 30, and but you can't use any of it.
Exactly. Now you get why. I'm at a loss for words. It's just stupid.
Gotcha. But there are small guys building their own, though.
Yep.
So
it's the it's the only thing they can do, right?
Okay.
But then again, of course, those small guys don't lease it either, because why would they?
They put all the work to get into the ground.
Yeah, now it's a competitive advantage, so why would they?
Sure.
So it's,
makes sense.
Yeah, there's no sharing, there is no leasing, there is no possibility of buying transport. It's stupid.
How fun. They'll come around another 100 years. You'll see it. You'll have your consciousness upnoted to the Matrix by then, so you'll be fine.
I would be happy if I would be seeing it in 100 years. That's all good with me.
All right.
Come on, Elon. You can do it.
I'm sure he can. He or somebody else. Somebody absolutely will do it. I think it might pump out of China first. They've got enough people over there working on the problem, I'm sure. Let's see. Let's stick a fork in it. Mikey, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they go about doing that?
Let's say the Little Brothers Slack channel on Patreon. So that way someone else can do it and leave me alone.
Okay, Thomas, if you want people to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
As I always say, I'm easy to find on the internet. Just Google for me. You'll find me on all the social networks and stuff. But the easiest always is unimus.net. We have live chat there. Just ask for me at the live chat and you'll get to me.
What kind of questions can they ask you on live chat? Just curious.
you should try and find out. Maybe something interesting will happen.
Come up with.
So does this live chat have like a video feed as well? Is that like, you know, do you take credit cards for this live chat?
Oh yeah, yeah. Just plug in your credit card number. I'll take it happily.
For sure. All right. If you want to find me, I'm at greg@gregsoul.com. That's my email address. Gregsoul.com is my blog. The most recent thing on there is probably not worth looking at. I made a ball retriever for my pickleball launcher. So yeah, go learn some really important technical stuff there.
I was waiting what you were going to say, with starting with the ball and then that hand gesture, but I mean, all right.
There you go. Yeah, it just picks them up. Blop, 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 blop. It's got a little hand.
Yeah, there you go.
I was spending more time picking them up than I was hitting. I was like, there's got to be a better way. Stop the madness. So I made one. Really cheap, of course, like me. Exceedingly inexpensive. But anyway, if you want to join the Slack that Mike was talking about, that's probably the best way to reach me, actually, as well. And that's patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You get in there, you throw us some bones, and we send you an invite to the Slack. And it's got a lot of great people in there, a lot of great discourse, dialogue, ask questions, comments, say random things, and people will respond with random things back to you. And slide into my DMs at any time. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me. I guess if you guys have any questions or comments, please keep them coming. I guess that's it, guys. Thanks. I'm gonna go eat something. I'm starving.
Bye, everybody.
Jokes were loud
and annoying,
but we're informative. Facts were not disappointing. Just give us a listen, cause fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.